Calling all podcast fans. Spotify makes it easier than ever to discover new shows to love. Get personalized episode recommendations and easily preview them before you dive right in. Find exclusive video episodes from your favorite hosts and guests. And with some, you can even connect with them through polls and Q&A directly within their episodes. It's everything you want in one app. So what are you waiting for? Try the podcast experience today on Spotify.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hey everyone, it's Carter. This week on Unsolved Murders, we're doing something a little different. We're excited to bring you Edgar Allan Poe's 1842 short story, The Mystery of Marie Roget, in which he attempted to solve a real murder case, as you've never heard it before. As many of our longtime listeners know, we covered the murder of Miss Mary Cecilia Rogers in February 2017 and explored the mysterious death of Edgar Allan Poe in October 2016. Every day this week, we will release an episode of our adaptation, which is considered to be one of the first murder mysteries to feature details from a real crime. This is the second episode of a five-part series. If you haven't listened to part one yet, check it out before resuming this episode. And don't forget to tune in tomorrow to continue the story. In part one, Edgar Allan Poe's bohemian detective C. Auguste Dupin and his assistant, our unnamed narrator, received a puzzling request from the Parisian police. Popular perfumery employee Marie Roget's body was found floating in the Seine. Because of severe decomposition and the fact that Marie had only disappeared 3 days prior, there is no consensus that the strangled body is even hers. So far, every lead has gone cold and the media frenzy has only just begun. Without further ado, we are excited to present part two of Unsolved Murders, The Mystery of Marie Roget. A day or two before the prefect called upon us, however, some important information reached the police, which seemed to overthrow, at least, the chief portion of Le Commercial's argument. Two small boys, sons of a Madame de Luc, while roaming among the woods near the Barrière du Roule, chanced to penetrate a close thicket, within which were three or four large stones, forming a kind of seat with a back and a footstool. On the upper stone lay a white petticoat, on the second a silk scarf. A parasol, gloves, and a pocket handkerchief were also here found. The handkerchief bore the name Marie Roget. Fragments of dress were discovered on the brambles around. The earth was trampled, the bushes were broken, and there was every evidence of a struggle. Between the thicket and the river, the fences were found taken down, and the ground bore evidence of some heavy burthen having been dragged along it. A weekly paper, Le Soleil, had the following comments upon this discovery, comments which merely echoed the sentiment of the whole Parisian press. Quote, "The things had all evidently been there at least 3 or 4 weeks. They were all mildewed down hard with the action of the rain and stuck together from mildew. The grass had grown around and over some of them. The silk on the parasol was strong, but the threads of it were run together within. The upper part, where it had been doubled and folded, was all mildewed and rotten, and tore on its being opened. The pieces of her frock, torn out by the bushes, were about 3 inches wide and 6 inches long. One part was the hem of the frock, and it had been mended. The other piece was part of the skirt, not the hem. They looked like strips torn off, and were on the thorn bush about a foot from the ground. There can be no doubt, therefore, that the spot of this appalling outrage has been discovered. Consequent upon this discovery, new evidence appeared. Madame de Luc testified that she keeps a roadside inn not far from the bank of the river, opposite the Barrière de Roule. The neighborhood is secluded, particularly so. It is the usual Sunday resort of blackguards from the city, who cross the river in boats. About 3 o'clock in the afternoon of the Sunday in question, a young girl arrived at the inn, accompanied by a young man of dark complexion. The two remained here for some time. On their departure, they took the road to some thick woods in the vicinity. Madame de Luc's attention was called to the dress worn by the girl on account of its resemblance to one worn by a deceased relative. A scarf was particularly noticed. Soon after the departure of the couple, a gang of miscreants made their appearance, behaved boisterously, ate and drank without making payment, followed in the route of the young man and girl, returned to the inn about dusk, and recrossed the river as if in great haste. It was soon after dark, upon the same evening, that Madame de Luc, as well as her eldest son, heard the screams of a female in the vicinity of the inn. The screams were violent but brief. Madame D recognized not only the scarf which was found in the thicket, but the dress which was discovered upon the corpse. An omnibus driver, Valence, now also testified that he saw Marie Roget cross a ferry on the Seine on the Sunday in question, in company with a young man of dark complexion. He, Valence, knew Marie and could not be mistaken in her identity. The articles found in the thicket were fully identified by the relatives of Marie. The items of evidence and information thus collected by myself from the newspapers at the suggestion of Dupin embraced only one more point, but this was a point of seemingly vast consequence. It appears that, immediately after the discovery of the clothes as above described, the lifeless or nearly lifeless body of St. Eustache, Marie's betrothed, was found in the vicinity of what all now suppose the scene of the outrage. A phial labeled laudanum and emptied was found near him. His breath gave evidence of the poison. He died without speaking. Upon his person was found a letter briefly stating his love for Marie with his design of self-destruction. In a moment, the case reveals itself to be anything but simple.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Now, back to the story. I need scarcely tell you, said Dupin, as he finished the perusal of my notes, that this is a far more intricate case than that of the Rue Morgue, from which it differs in one important respect. This is an ordinary, although an atrocious, instance of crime. There is nothing peculiarly outré about it. You will observe that, for this reason, the mystery has been considered easy, when, for this reason, it should have been considered difficult of solution. Thus, at first, it was thought unnecessary to offer a reward. The Myrmidons of G were able at once to comprehend how and why such an atrocity might have been committed. They could picture to their imaginations a mode, many modes, and a motive, many motives. And because it was not impossible that either of these numerous modes and motives could have been the actual one, they have taken it for granted that one of them must. But the case with which these variable fancies were entertained, and the very plausibility which each assumed, should have been understood as indicative rather of the difficulties than of the facilities which must attend elucidation. I have before observed that it is by prominences above the plane of the ordinary that reason feels her way, if at all, in her search for the true, and that the proper question in cases such as this is not so much what has occurred as what has occurred that has never occurred before. In the investigations at the house of Madame L'Espanier, the agents of G were discouraged and confounded by that very unusualness which, to a properly regulated intellect, would have afforded the surest omen of success. While this same intellect might have been plunged in despair at the ordinary character of all that met the eye in the case of the perfumery girl, and yet told of nothing but easy triumph to the functionaries of the prefecture. In the case of Madame L'Espanier and her daughter, there was, even at the beginning of our investigation, no doubt that murder had been committed. The idea of suicide was excluded at once. Here, too, we are freed at the commencement from all supposition of self-murder. The body found at the Barrière du Roule was found under such circumstances as to leave us no room for embarrassment upon this important point. But it has been suggested that the corpse discovered is not that of Marie Roget, for the conviction of whose assassin or assassins the reward is offered, and respecting whom, solely, our agreement has been arranged with the prefect. We both know this gentleman well. It will not do to trust him too far. If, dating our inquiries from the body found, and thence tracing a murderer, we yet discover this body to be that of some other individual than Marie, or, if starting from the living Marie, we find her, yet find her unassassinated, in either case we lose our labor, since it is Monsieur G with whom we have to deal. For our own purpose, therefore, if not for the purpose of justice, it is indispensable that our first step should be the determination of the identity of the corpse with the Marie Roget, who is missing. With the public, the arguments of L'Etoile have had weight, and that the journal itself is convinced of their importance would appear from the manner in which it commences one of its essays upon the subject. Several of the morning papers of the day, it says, speak of the conclusive article in Monday's L'Etoile. To me, this article appears conclusive of little beyond the zeal of its inditer. We should bear in mind that, in general, it is the object of our newspapers rather to create a sensation, to make a point, than to further the cause of truth. The latter end is only pursued when it seems coincident with the former. The print which merely falls in with ordinary opinion, however well-founded this opinion may be, earns for itself no credit with the mob. The mass of the people regard as profound only him who suggests pungent contradictions of the general idea. In ratiocination, not less than in literature, it is the epigram which is the most immediately and the most universally appreciated. In both, it is of the lowest order of merit. What I mean to say is that it is the mingled epigram and melodrama of the idea that Marie Roget still lives, rather than any true plausibility in this idea, which have suggested it to L'Etoile and secured it a favorable reception with the public. Let us examine the heads of this journal's argument, endeavoring to avoid the incoherence with which it is originally set forth. The first aim of the writer is to show, from the brevity of the interval between Marie's disappearance and the finding of the floating corpse, that this corpse cannot be that of Marie. The reduction of this interval to its smallest possible dimension becomes thus at once an object with the reasoner. In the rash pursuit of this object, he rushes into mere assumption at the outset. "It is folly to suppose," he says, "that the murder, if murder was committed on her body, could have been consummated soon enough to enable her murderers to throw the body into the river before midnight." We demand at once, and very naturally, why? Why is it folly to suppose that the murder was committed within 5 minutes after the girl's quitting her mother's house? Why is it folly to suppose that the murder was committed at any given period of the day? There have been assassinations at all hours. But Had the murder taken place at any moment between 9 o'clock in the morning of Sunday and a quarter before midnight, there would still have been time enough to throw the body into the river before midnight. This assumption, then, amounts precisely to this, that the murder was not committed on Sunday at all, and if we allow L'Etoile to assume this, we may permit it any liberties whatever. The paragraph beginning, "It is folly to suppose that the murder, etc., however it appears as printed in L'Etoile, may be imagined to have existed actually thus in the brain of its inditer. It is folly to suppose that the murder, if murder was committed on the body, could have been committed soon enough to have enabled her murderers to throw the body into the river before midnight. It is folly, we say, to suppose all this, and to suppose at the same time, as we are resolved to suppose, that the body was not thrown in until after midnight. A sentence sufficiently inconsequential in itself, but not so utterly preposterous as the one printed." Up next, Dupin considers the corpse itself. Now, back to the story. "Were it my purpose," continued Dupin, "merely to make out a case against this passage of L'Etoile's argument, I might safely leave it where it is. It is not, however, with L'Etoile that we have to do, but with the truth. The sentence in question has but one meaning, as it stands, and this meaning I have fairly stated. But it is material that we go behind the mere words for an idea which these words have obviously intended and failed to convey. It was the design of the journalist to say that, at whatever period of the day or night Sunday this murder was committed, it was improbable that the assassins would have ventured to bear the corpse to the river before midnight. And herein lies, really, the assumption of which I complain. It is assumed that the murder was committed at such a position, and under such circumstances, that the bearing it to the river became necessary. Now, the assassination might have taken place upon the river's brink, or on the river itself, and thus, the throwing the corpse in the water might have been resorted to at any period of the day or night as the most obvious and most immediate mode of disposal. You will understand that I suggest nothing here as probable or as coincident with my own opinion. My design, so far, has no reference to the facts of the case. I wish merely to caution you against the whole tone of L'Etoile's suggestion by calling your attention to its ex parte character at the outset. Having prescribed thus a limit to suit its own preconceived notions, having assumed that, if this were the body of Marie, it could have been in the water but a very brief time, the journal goes on to say, "All experience has shown that drowned bodies, or bodies thrown into water immediately after death by violence, require from 6 to 10 days for sufficient decomposition to take place to bring them to the top of the water. Even when a cannon is fired over a corpse and it rises before at least 5 or 6 days' immersion, it sinks again if let alone." These assertions have been tacitly received by every paper in Paris, with the exception of Le Moniteur. This latter print endeavors to combat that portion of the paragraph which has reference to drowned bodies only, by citing some 5 or 6 instances in which the bodies of individuals known to be drowned were found floating after the lapse of less time than is insisted upon by L'Etoile. But there is something excessively unphilosophical in the attempt on the part of Le Moniteur to rebut the general assertion of L'Etoile by citation of particular instances militating against that assertion. Had it been possible to adduce 50 instead of 5 examples of bodies found floating at the end of 2 or 3 days, these 50 examples could still have been properly regarded only as exceptions to L'Etoile's rule, until such time as the rule itself should be confuted. Admitting the rule, and this Le Moniteur does not deny, insisting merely upon its exceptions, the argument of L'Etoile is suffered to remain in full force, for this argument does not pretend to involve more than a question of the probability of the body having risen to the surface in less than 3 days. And this probability will be in favor of L'Etoile's position until the instances so childishly adduced shall be sufficient in number to establish an antagonistical rule. You will see at once that all argument upon this head should be urged, if at all, against the rule itself. And for this end, we must examine the rationale of the rule. Now, the human body, in general, is neither much lighter nor much heavier than the water of the Seine. That is to say, the specific gravity of the human body, in its natural condition, is about equal to the bulk of fresh water which it displaces. The bodies of fat and fleshy persons, with small bones, and of women generally, are lighter than those of the lean and large-boned, and of men. And the specific gravity of the water of a river is somewhat influenced by the presence of the tide from sea. But, leaving this tide out of question, it may be said that very few human bodies will sink at all, even in fresh water, of their own accord. Almost anyone, falling into a river, will be enabled to float, if he suffer the specific gravity of the water fairly to be adduced in comparison with his own. That is to say, if he suffer his whole person to be immersed with as little exception as possible. The proper position for one who cannot swim is the upright position of the walker on land, with the head thrown fully back and immersed, the mouth and nostrils alone remaining above the surface. Thus circumstanced, we shall find that we float without difficulty and without exertion. It is evident, however, that the gravities of the body and of the bulk of water displaced are very nicely balanced, and that a trifle will cause either to preponderate. An arm, for instance, uplifted from the water, and thus deprived of its support, is an additional weight sufficient to immerse the whole head, while the accidental aid of the smallest piece of timber will enable us to elevate the head so as to look about. Now, in the struggles of one unused to swimming, the arms are invariably thrown upwards, while an attempt is made to keep the head in its usual perpendicular position. The result is the immersion of the mouth and nostrils, and the inception, during efforts to breathe while beneath the surface, of water into the lungs. Much is also received into the stomach, and the whole body becomes heavier by the difference between the weight of the air originally distending these cavities and that of the fluid which now fills them. This difference is sufficient to cause the body to sink, as a general rule, but is insufficient in the cases of individuals with small bones and an abnormal quantity of flaccid or fatty matter. Such individuals float even after drowning. The corpse, being supposed at the bottom of the river, will there remain until, by some means, its specific gravity again becomes less than that of the bulk of water which it displaces. This effect is brought about by decomposition, or otherwise. The result of decomposition is the generation of gas, distending the cellular tissues and all the cavities, and giving the puffed appearance which is so horrible. When this distension has so far progressed that the bulk of the corpse is materially increased without a corresponding increase of mass or weight, its specific gravity becomes less than that of the water displaced, and it forthwith makes its appearance at the surface. But decomposition is modified by innumerable circumstances, is hastened or retarded by innumerable agencies, for example, by the heat or cold of the season, by the mineral impregnation or purity of the water, by its depth or shallowness, by its currency or stagnation, by the temperament of the body, by its infection or freedom from disease before death. Thus, it is evident that we can assign no period with anything like accuracy at which the corpse shall rise through decomposition. Under certain conditions, this result would be brought about within an hour. Under others, it might not take place at all. There are chemical infusions by which the animal frame can be preserved forever from corruption. The bichloride of mercury is one. But apart from decomposition, there may be, and very usually is, a generation of gas within the stomach from the acetous fermentation of vegetable matter, or within other cavities from other causes, sufficient to induce a distension which will bring the body to the surface. The effect produced by the firing of a cannon is that of simple vibration. This may either loosen the corpse from the soft mud or ooze in which it is embedded, thus permitting it to rise when other agencies have already prepared it for so doing, or it may overcome the tenacity of some putrescent portions of the cellular tissue, allowing the cavities to distend under the influence of the gas. Having thus before us the whole philosophy of this subject, we can easily test by it the assertions of L'Etoile. All experience shows, says this paper, that drowned bodies, or bodies thrown into the water immediately after death by violence, require from 6 to 10 days for sufficient decomposition to take place to bring them to the top of the water, even when a cannon is fired over a corpse and it rises before at least 5 or 6 days immersion, it sinks again if left alone. The whole of this paragraph must now appear a tissue of inconsequence and incoherence. All experience does not show that drowned bodies require from 6 to 10 days for sufficient decomposition to take place to bring them to the surface. Both science and experience show that the period of their rising is, and necessarily must be, indeterminate. If, moreover, a body has risen to the surface through firing of cannon, it will not sink again if let alone, until decomposition has so far progressed as to permit the escape of the generated gas. But I wish to call your attention to the distinction which is made between drowned bodies and bodies thrown into the water immediately after death by violence. Although the writer admits the distinction, he yet includes them all in the same category. I have shown how it is that the body of a drowning man becomes specifically heavier than its bulk of water, and that he would not sink at all except for the struggles by which he elevates his arms above the surface, and his gasps for breath while beneath the surface, gasps which supply by water the place of the original air in the lungs. But these struggles and these gasps would not occur in the body thrown into the water immediately after death by violence. Thus, in the latter instance, the body, as a general rule, would not sink at all, a fact of which L'Etoile is evidently ignorant. When decomposition had proceeded to a very great extent, when the flesh had in a great measure left the bones, then, indeed, but not till then, should we lose sight of the corpse. Thank you for listening to part 2 of our 5-episode series covering the mystery of Marie Roget. Tomorrow in part 3, Dupin criticizes 3 Parisian newspapers over their incorrect assumptions about the case and disputes the accusations leveled against the man who found Marie's body. Tune in tomorrow to continue the story. Unsolved Murders True Crime Stories was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler. Sound design by Kenny Hobbs, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, and Freddie Beckley. I'm Carter Roy.